Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome to the Anthropocene, the age of human die-offs. We have been living in, for the past couple hundred years, in large part because of our ability to use fossil fuels to increase our capacity to grow food. We have been living in a halcyon era, in an era of extraordinary prosperity and health. And I mean, even the poorest in the world are better off than the poorest in the world were 100 years ago or 200 years ago. We convert fossil fuels into fertilizer, which allows us to grow more food on the same amount of land. We convert fossil fuels into pesticides and herbicides, which allow us to outcompete our competitors, the weeds and the bugs. The result of this is that, you know, we've gone from more than 70% of us being farmers 200 years ago to only 2% of us being farmers now, because our land has become so productive as a consequence of our use of fossil fuels. And guess what? Fossil fuels are becoming harder to find, more expensive to produce, and they're destroying our planet. Now, this possibility that we are facing, in fact, I would say probability, that we are facing large-scale food shortages around the world. There's already famine going on in several countries in the world as we speak. But I'm talking about large scale, like as in not just two or three countries, but dozens, maybe eventually hundreds of countries. And here in the United States, the depopulation of large parts of the United States, when Lake Mead is gone, when you know, what's that going to do? The Colorado River is drying up. Jim Turr sent me a note this morning with a picture of the Rio Grande in New Mexico. It's just a trickle now. This is seriously impacting our ability to grow food, because these rivers and these reservoirs are the source of water that we use to irrigate our crops. Irrigation is another thing, again, you know, provided by fossil fuels. It's not, you know, it's not being irrigated with oil, but the pumps that get the water to the fields and put the water on the fields are all run by either electricity or gasoline, and the electricity more often than not is made from fossil fuels. So here we are. Now, other cultures have experienced these kinds of population crashes as a consequence of running out of their food supply in the past. Probably the most well-documented one is the Maori people of New Zealand, who, 800 or 900 years ago, first discovered that island. They were Melanesian sailors. They discovered a 103,000 square mile island, New Zealand, and spent the next couple hundred years eating all the moa birds. These are giant birds like ostriches, only they weigh as much as 500 pounds. And you can just walk up to them and break their necks and eat them. And so for hundreds of years, the Moray just spread all across the island and their population exploded and the Moa birds got fewer and became fewer and fewer and fewer until finally all 12 species, they ate the last Moa bird, this great extinction. And the consequence of that great extinction was that the Moray went from being a very peaceful people. In fact, in the archaeological record, there's literally no evidence of warfare during the first 300 years that they occupied New Zealand. None. They were a peaceful people. They didn't have spears and bows and arrows. They didn't need them. You could just walk up to a bird and break its neck and have dinner. But when the Moa were all gone, the Moray started, their culture changed. It became a warlike society. They began building forts all over the island. When one war party went against another war party, they would bring food on the hoof, a captured prisoner. They had descended into cannibalism. Now, that was a local event. We also saw in North America, there's a new book out. I was reading it over this last weekend. That's just an amazing book. First Peoples in the New World, Populating Ice Age America by David Meltzer. It's just an amazing book, First Peoples in the New World. And he talks about how, I mean, we now have DNA tracking, right, for all these Aboriginal people, these indigenous people of North America. And there were dozens of tribes that had unique, distinct DNA signatures that literally no longer exist because they lived in parts of North America where the climate changed. This was the tail end of the Ice Age. The climate changed and all the food went away. And they died out. They literally died out. Periodic famine has been the norm for humanity throughout most of our history. But now we don't have the option that many people around the world have. I mean, you're seeing climate refugees right now. Guatemalan climate refugees are showing up at our southern border. Syrian climate refugees are showing up in Italy and Greece. Bangladeshi climate refugees are showing up throughout that region. But we're running out of places to go because now climate change is not local. It's affecting the entire planet. Yes, it's affecting different places more vigorously than other places. Now, one of the learnings that I got out of this and out of this study, and I've been really digging into the Native American history of America for the last, I don't know, month or two since I've been writing this new book, The Hidden History of American Democracy, because so much of our democracy was grounded on things like the Iroquois Confederacy and the Wendat people. Digging into it, one of the things that I've learned is that a lot of anthropologists believe that one of the reasons that so many Native American societies had sustainability as their highest value, from, you know, low reproduction rates to maintaining their food supply, was because they had suffered through periods of famine in the past when they overkilled the local fauna and flora. So the question, and I wrap this article with this question, is, you know, will we, like the ancient Moray, devolve into an authoritarian and war-based society? Or will we, like the Iroquois or the Hopi or the Wendat people, make a conscious decision to live within our means, to stop destroying our environment, to fine-tune our governmental systems to meet the needs of all of our citizens? I mean, we're not without resources, and I would never bet against human ingenuity. But on the other hand, we're facing an unprecedented level of avarice mobilized by billionaires and corporations with more power and wealth than the world has literally ever seen before. Are they going to win and in the process set human civilization back millennia? Or will we, humanity, prevail over the forces of greed and destruction and help salvage our biosphere while reinventing our culture and our world? The climate emergency we worried about is here. Our normal climate is dead. There's this amazing new study. It's in the American Meteorological Society's Journal of Climate, a peer-reviewed publication. It's absolutely shocking. Here's a quote from it. They're talking about major heat waves that affect multiple continents. This is all Northern Hemisphere stuff, but it's happening in the Southern Hemisphere as well. They said such simultaneous heat waves are 7 times more likely now than 40 years ago. That would have been when Reagan was elected president. 7 times more likely. They're also hotter and affect a larger area. They go on to note that in the 1980s, the Northern Hemisphere averaged 73 heat waves during the summer months from May to September. By the 2010s, that number had grown to 152 heat waves per summer. And those heat waves are now 20% hotter. This is because the jet stream is collapsing. And this is why we're seeing weather patterns that, instead of moving quickly through with a little bit of rain or a little bit of drought, are becoming massive flooding events or massive drought events or heat wave events. We last summer here in Portland, it was 116 degrees. It was not a normal summer. All over America, we're seeing this. We're seeing all kinds of flight delays. Now, some of them are the result of, you know, bad planning on the part of the airlines and pilot strikes and things like that. But a lot of them have to do with weather, because our storms are so much larger and more severe than they used to be. So, you know, here we are with the jet stream collapsing. We've had, you know, had lengthy conversations with numerous, you know, Michael Mann and Jason Box and other climate scientists about this. What would have been a rainstorm lasting a few hours is now a 3-day downpour that floods an entire state or an entire region. What would have been a 1-day cold snap that causes a small problem becomes a 3-day, you know, shutting down the entire state of Texas. The jet stream didn't even use to go as far south as Texas, but because the Arctic ice has melted in the summer, you don't have that giant refrigerator at the top that is holding the jet stream in place. So this is our new normal. What are we going to do about it? Well, the top recipients of fossil fuel money in Congress so far this year, just this year, number 1, Joe Manchin, number 2, Kevin McCarthy, James Lankford, August Fugger, John Kennedy of Louisiana, Lisa Murkowski, Kirsten Sinema. Sinema and Manchin, by the way, the only 2 Democrats on this list. Lizzie Fletcher, Henry Cuellar, oops, he's a Democrat, sorry. The anti-abortion Democrat, in fact, down in Texas. Tim Scott, Steve Scalise, Tony Gonzalez, and Marco Rubio. This is from opensecrets.org. The highest recipients of fossil fuel money throughout their political careers. Number 1 is Mitt Romney, with over $8 million taken in from the fossil fuel industry. Number 2, John Cornyn. Number 3, Ted Cruz. John McCain, Mitch McConnell, Kevin McCarthy, Barack Obama, Kay Bailey Hutchinson, James Inhofe, Steve Pierce, Joe Barton, Kevin Brady, Cory Gardner, Phil Graham, Steve Scalise, and Lisa Murkowski. Americans are dying because these paid-off shills have either failed to act or actively blocked any meaningful change in our nation's climate policy. And I would say these people have blood on their hands, taking all this money from an industry that has been lying to us since the 60s, when they first figured out with absolute certainty, or a high degree of certainty, that this day was coming. That, you know, just, you know, within a generation or two, we were going to see disastrous climate change. We are there now. We are here now. And we have to do something about this. This is just so wrong. A new study suggesting that the climate is changing faster than we thought. And also, now it seems figuring out what happened with this deadly Pacific heat wave that we had last summer, where here in Portland we had 116 degree weather for 3 days in a row. On the line with us is our old friend Dr. Michael Mann, the distinguished professor of meteorology, the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University, member of the National Academy of Sciences, recipient of the Tyler Prize, author of several books, including The Madhouse Effect, and most recently, The New Climate War. Michael Mann with 2Ns.net is his website, and Michael E. Mann with 2Ns is his Twitter handle. Professor Mann, welcome back to the program. This new study that suggests that some of the changes in the Southern Hemisphere that were predicted for 2080 are happening now. What's going on here?
These are interesting studies. They really sort of reinforce something that many of us have been saying for some time, that, you know, the climate models aren't perfect. The critics love to point to uncertainties in the models as if they are a reason for inaction. But the reality is just the opposite, because as we learn more about the processes that play out in the climate system, we're encountering some surprises, and they're not welcome surprises. They are surprises that tell us, for example, that climate change is having some subtle impacts on the jet streams in both hemispheres, in the southern hemisphere, and that's what one of these studies is about, winter storms in the southern hemisphere that may be getting stronger for subtle reasons that aren't necessarily well captured in the climate models. And then in the northern hemisphere, we're talking about this Pacific heat dome, this Pacific Northwest heat dome that we experienced last summer. And now coming into the next summer, we can expect to see more of these sorts of events. And what this study, this latest study about the heat dome, tells us once again is there are some aspects of that event having to do with the very deep, high pressure that allowed for that heat and that record heat. That high pressure was part of that event. That has to do with what's known as ridging in the atmosphere, the way that high pressures and low pressure centers cause wiggles in the jet stream, and those high pressure centers can get stuck in place. That ridge can be very persistent. That's what we saw with that heat dome event. And again, the climate models aren't necessarily really capturing the way that climate change is leading to these greater wiggles in the jet stream and these very persistent high and low pressure systems that give us these extreme summer weather events. Some of my own research over the last few years involves, again, an understanding, an attempt to understand some of those processes that may not be very well captured in the climate models. And what that means is that we may be in store for more extreme weather than the models predict. I'll make one last point here. The warming of the planet is proceeding pretty much on pace, as the models predicted. The problem is some of the consequences of that warming are playing out earlier and quite profoundly, as we see with these examples.
You're listening to Tom Hartmann.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe, now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
A few years ago, we were talking about 2100 and you know, the far, I won't live to see 2100. My grandchildren will, but, or hopefully, but I won't. I think a lot of people were like, okay, you know, let's do something about it, but let's not panic or freak out. I don't mean to say, is it time to panic and freak out, but are things happening much, much faster than we anticipated, just say 5 years ago?
Warming is pretty much on schedule. The models predicted that quite well. What we're seeing play out there is as predicted, and that's bad enough, because we're seeing the consequences of that warming now in the form of these extreme weather events that in many cases are more extreme than what the climate models predicted. The ice sheets, we're starting to see ice shelves collapse, Greenland, larger amounts of melting than we expected at this point. So there's the danger that the ice sheets begin to collapse earlier than we expected. They contribute to sea level rise earlier than we expected. So as I like to say, there is great urgency. If we continue to spew carbon pollution into the atmosphere and we continue to warm up the planet, we will see far worse consequences. And they will. Some of those consequences will be locked in for the long term. There's no going back once we cross some of those potential tipping points with ice melt and other processes that once they kick into gear, they're hard to stop. And so what this tells us is that, look, we're seeing dangerous climate change already. We'll see far more dangerous consequences if we continue. Many of those consequences are tied to the overall warming of the planet. And the good news is that the models tell us we can basically stop the planet from warming up if we bring carbon emissions to zero quickly. And so that's what it's all about right now, getting off fossil fuels as quickly as possible.
You mentioned the jet stream, jet streams, I guess, northern and southern hemisphere.
Yeah.
And that's the atmosphere, the air around us. At the same time, we're seeing, you know, the bleaching of the of coral reefs all around the world. The one in Australia, the Great Barrier Reef, is probably the most famous. And we're seeing changes in fisheries. We're seeing this out here in the Pacific Northwest as a consequence of both low oxygen areas that seem to have to do with temperature changes and just temperature changes themselves, where the fish are comfortable and not. And I guess we saw that some decades ago with cod on the Northeast. Correct me if I'm wrong. What's the relationship between these two things, between the oceans warming and the air warming? And what do you think about some of the proposals that have been put together to, for example, seed the ocean with tiny amounts of iron particles to pull carbon out of the ocean and help restore some balance there and ultimately perhaps pull that carbon out of the atmosphere as well?
Yeah, I mean, the oceans are really being subject to multiple insults. The rise in carbon dioxide is literally acidifying the oceans. And so we're seeing that ocean acidification threatening coral reefs, threatening shellfish in, you know, places like, as you say, off the west coast of the United States. And we are also seeing deoxygenation. As you warm up water, it can hold less dissolved oxygen. And that's a threat to the fish species, the marine life that occupy the world oceans. And so on top of that is the warming of the oceans as well, and that leads to coral bleaching. And so you've got sort of these multiple insults: ocean acidification, deoxygenation, and warming. And they're all tied together. They're all basically tied to the carbon pollution that we're pumping into the atmosphere. About 90% of the heating is going into the oceans. That's where most of the heat gets stored. So we pay a lot of attention to the oceans. And while surface temperatures fluctuate quite a bit, so not every year sets a new record for the surface temperature of the planet, every year does set a new record for the temperature of the oceans. It's a much more steady indicator of the warming of the planet. And look, we rely upon healthy oceans as a species. If we lose the oceans, then we're really in trouble. Clearly, there are scenarios where if we continue down this road, our future starts to resemble a dystopian future. The good news is that there is time to make sure that that's not our legacy. There is still time to reduce our carbon emissions so that our legacy is not to leave behind a damaged planet for our children.
And if you want to learn more about it, check out Dr. Mann's new book, The New Climate War. Professor Mann, thanks so much for dropping by. It's great talking.
Thank you. Always a pleasure, Tom.
Thank you. Back at you. Remarkable stuff. Tim in Midland, Texas. Hey, Tim, it says you disagree with me. What's up?
The effort is a little bit misguided to attack the United States when other countries' oil and gas industry is much more pollutant than ours. You look at China and all the coal-fired electrical plants they're building currently and proposed. They do not have the EPA. They do not have any checks and balances on how they mine oil and gas, how they process oil and gas, how they transport oil and gas. And I think if we would concentrate more on getting those countries better aligned, that it would go a lot farther to what a lot of the climate change folks are focused on.
It is important, Tim. I don't disagree with you there. You do realize that China is converting to solar power faster than any other country on Earth, roughly 10 times the rate that the United States is right now.
And that's good, but look at the destruction to the environment that they
should not prevent us from doing something.
Well, we've been doing it, but the problem, one of the problems in us doing it is everything that we do with solar and
wind,
electrical EVs are not reliable sources of energy. We have tons of windmills in West Texas. I drive by them all the time. And in many cases, we'll have a 40-mile-an-hour wind blowing, and the windmills have to remain idle because it's too much wind. The blades bend back, you know, hit the towers and cause problems. Also, with the windmills, the life of the blades are about 8 or 10 years. So when they reach the end of their life, they have to be disposed of, which is problematic.
Yeah, or recycled. Yeah, Europe is doing a fine job with this, as is Texas and Iowa. I mean, in your state, you're getting about 20% of your power from renewables. So, yeah, there will be times when the wind or the sun vary. But, you know, that's why you build a comprehensive grid system and you put storage into it. Tim, none of these are reasons not to convert from fossil fuels, which are destroying our planet, to green energy sources. Dave in Federal Way, Washington. Hey, Dave, what's up?
You were talking about climate change, and you mentioned, you know, are we going to go the path of the warlike tribal confederations of North America or the more peaceful? And I believe we're going to go the warlike path of European tribal cultures.
It's very much a possibility.
Well, the reason why I say that is, you know, and I'm not trying to be Mr. Smarty Pants. The reason why I say that is because if you look at Europe, it is really a subcontinent. The North American and South American tribes had a degree of geographical isolation. Europe has always been a crossroads, all right, that's led to all kinds of social tensions and basically a warlike evolution. And I believe we're seeing it play out now. And to tell you the truth, like Donald Trump's speech, you know, he said things in there that were nonsensical, like syringes all over American streets. I was like, what decade is this guy living in? But see, that is all code. That is all code. Trump now is like a symbol to Trump voters. He's like the American flag, okay? He is a symbol, an icon. They know that it's nonsense, but just like Adolf Hitler, you know, Adolf Hitler was obsessed with architecture, okay, and making the cities great again in Germany and everything. You mentioned all that, but Hitler lacked the engineering prowess to make it happen. But some of those things they did make happen and exist to this day.
Yeah,
and
like the Autobahn, you know, yeah. And the Volkswagen.
Yes, and as far as how does this relate to climate change is, look, man, I was listening to a right-wing show, and of course they were talking about how carbon dioxide's actually a good thing. They pump it into greenhouses, right?
Yeah, that's crazy.
It is crazy, but it's typical of the American right. But I heard a guy on the left, I'm not going to mention his name, I really respect him, but he was so depressed over Joe Manchin's betrayal on all this that he was actually talking about how CO2 is a good thing, too. And I just want to say that, look, man, malaria
is not a good thing.
No, malaria used to be on every continent on this planet, okay? Seeing the effects of climate change real and right now. And, I mean, you know, as far as, like, if you want to look at through the geologic record, you got to go back to the Piacenzian, which was 2.5 million years ago. A lot of vast inland seas. Florida was covered by an inland sea, et cetera. The Karoo Basin. Right,
what's the point you're trying to make here, Dave?
Climate change is here. It is real, and the results are, if you look to the past, you will understand the present.
Yeah, that book I was talking about that I've been reading over the weekend, it was just breathtaking about tribe after tribe across North America that suddenly the climate changed, and they literally just died out. Suzanne in Dublin, Ohio. Hey, Suzanne, what's on your mind today?
Yes, I just want to add a thought to the beginning of your show about the food and water supply shortage. And if more people were vegan, it would help because a lot of water is used, huge amounts of water, to grow the grain, to feed the cattle and the animals.
Yep.
And not only would it benefit people's health, it would benefit the food and water shortages.
Yeah, I completely agree. I used to have, in the first edition of Prophet's Way, I had this. And I don't know if I have a copy of it here. I should look around for it. In any case, I had this whole long thing that John Robbins had written long ago about how much water it took to produce a pound of meat, how much grain it took, how much fossil fuel and everything else. And you are absolutely right, Suzanne. One of the major, you know, agriculture is one of the major uses of fossil fuels, and agriculture is one of those areas, or at least the way that we eat, our food supply, is one of those areas where we could make really significant changes that would reduce our carbon footprint hugely and would improve our overall health. But those changes are not being made right now because you've got industries that are very, very wealthy, the meat industry and the dairy industry in particular, very wealthy industries, that because the Supreme Court legalized political bribery, they own enough politicians that they can prevent any kind of change at a systemic level. So we have to just campaign for it at the individual level and talk about, hey, you know, become a vegan or just, you know, cut your meat consumption or fish consumption or whatever it may be back to, you know, once a week or once a month. And not only will you be healthier, but the planet will be too.
and you'll save money.
Yes. A lot of institutions don't want us to know this because they benefit monetarily.
That's correct. And, yeah. Yep. You said it very well, Suzanne. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Mark in Long Beach, California. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Southwest has a terrible water problem. There's a partial solution going on right now. They're trying to refill the Salton Sea by pumping the treated wastewater over the hills down into the Salton Sea. But they just want to import enough to fill it. Mm-hmm. But there's this idea of if instead of spending that $6 plus billion with that project, you bore a tunnel down to the Salton Sea and you put all the reclaimed wastewater, which is like 900 million gallons a day going to the ocean of drinkable water, then it could go down there. They would have more water than they need because if
so the Salton Sea then becomes a reservoir for Southern California. I'm not all that familiar with the geography of the area.
Then you pump the salty water out of the Salton Sea into an area in the desert where then you spray it in the air and the 120-degree weather turns it into clouds, which blow up against the Chocolate Mountains and the Sierra Nevada Mountains, and it all rains down in the Colorado River, which is already infrastructure that's built to feed the area.
It's going to take an enormous amount of fossil fuel to make that happen. Wouldn't that energy be better put to work simply distilling seawater?
Once it's built, gravity is your main power source to bring water downhill to the Salton Sea, which is below sea level.
Right, but you got to pump it uphill first. Los Angeles is basically at sea level. I mean, if you're going to get water up into the mountains there, you're going to have to pump it up.
That's why I said bore a hole downhill.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And then solar distills the water, and it comes back to existing infrastructure. I've been pushing it for 25 years with senators and representatives, but they all scurry away.
Yeah. Well, it's an idea, Mark. Keep thinking. Keep thinking and keep promoting your ideas. Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. With higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR, all into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. It's accessible from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/Hartman with two N's. netsuite.com/Hartman. That's netsuite.com/Hartman.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Cliff in Santa Clarita, California. Hey, Cliff, thanks for watching us on Free Speech TV. What's on your mind today?
The old sail ships gave way to the steam engine. The horse and buggy gave way to the automobile. And even the Wright brothers plane evolved into rocket ships to space, right? And this is all done in the name of progress. Progress. It's like a human instinct. So when the combustion engine was invented, it was for progress. With the unintended consequences of 100 years later, what we're doing to the planet. The planet's burning up right now. And I can't imagine that anybody had the foresight of what was to come as far as the global warming or climate catastrophe.
The fossil fuel industry knew this in the 1970s. They knew it was possible in the 60s. They knew it was right. it was starting in the 70s. They didn't have any idea of the timeline. By the mid-1980s, the middle of the Reagan Revolution, the fossil fuel industry knew exactly what was going to happen and had a pretty good estimate of the timeline. You know, the last time the planet had this level of CO2 in the atmosphere, there were palm trees in Antarctica. This was 3 million years ago. If you think 102 degrees is bad, just wait 10 years. These 100-degree days are going to be 110-degree days.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing, Tom. A good friend of mine, Jerry, he reminded me, like in the turn of the century when the factories were being built, the Industrial Revolution, there were actually people back then, Tom, scientists, they weren't environmentalists, but scientists and concerned citizens that were actually writing articles about, you know, the pollution that was going into the air.
Yep.
And they might have even known that it was warming, but they had no idea the timeline. Like you said, they didn't realize what would be happening to us now in these days. And then there was the, you know, the mass migration to the urban centers, you know, for jobs and stuff. But my question, Tom, is wasn't it inevitable that something like this would have happened? Because of the way things played out, how could we have avoided it? You know, this progress meant more than anything. So there was, how could we have avoided what we're dealing with right now, given the circumstances?
We could have listened to Jimmy Carter in 1978, I think it was. You know.
Okay, but the factories were being built in the 1910s and 20s.
Oh yeah, so well obviously
Jimmy Carter.
But we have dumped, I'd have to go back and look at the numbers, but I believe that about half of the total emissions from the United States have only happened in the last 30 or 40 years.
Okay.
We have been going on an exponential curve in terms of emissions ever since the 1950s. You know, when Eisenhower was president, there was about half as many people in America as we have right now. Our population, you know, was under 200 million. So when he talks about, you know, we got 2 million more people in unions, well, you only had a workforce. Right now, the workforce is, I think it's 120 million or 110 million. Back then, it was around 50, 60 million. So that was a huge number, you know. Double check my numbers, by the way. I'm doing this from memory, but I think I'm pretty close. This is, we really needed to listen to Jimmy Carter. I mean, that's the bottom line. You know, he tried to create that solar bank and everything else. In fact, I'll play that clip in a few minutes. But yeah. Cliff, thank you very much. Thanks for the call. That's what we should have done. And it wasn't like it was a secret. I mean, the president of the United States went on national television and said, hey, guys, listen to this. The planet is melting down. If you think 102-degree, 103-degree days are bad, just wait 10, 15 years. Those top peak heat days are going to be 110 or 115 in just a decade or so, in my opinion. I mean, I'm not a meteorologist, but look at what's going on. Last time there was this much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, we had palm trees in Antarctica. And Cliff's question was, you know, what could we have done? Did we see this coming? I mean, what could we have done? And let me just share with you what President Jimmy Carter had to say to the nation. I mean, this wasn't a secret. The President of the United States in 1978 came before the American people and said this.
The energy crisis is real. It is worldwide. It is a clear and present danger to our nation. These are facts, and we simply must face them. What I have to say to you now about energy is simple and vitally important. Point one, I am tonight setting a clear goal for the energy policy of the United States. Beginning this moment, this nation will never use more foreign oil than we did in 1977. Never.
Yeah, and then he laid out the solar bank.
Moreover, I will soon submit legislation to Congress calling for the creation of this nation's first solar bank, which will help us achieve the crucial goal of 20% of our energy coming from solar power by the year 2000.
By the year 2000. It would not be as hot as it is right now if Jimmy Carter had not been defeated by fossil fuel money in the Reagan Revolution. It would not be as hot as it is right now if Ronald Reagan hadn't taken Jimmy Carter's solar panels off the roof of the White House, but it had continued Carter's programs. But instead, throughout the 80s, the Reagan administration and the Republican Party lied to us about what they knew about global warming. The fossil fuel industry lied to us about what they knew about global warming, funded hundreds of millions, perhaps billions of dollars worth of publicity and PR, lies promoting the idea, oh, no, CO2 is good. It's plant food. You need more CO2 in the atmosphere. And here we are. a heat wave that is destroying America. Kentucky just had, you know, a dozen or more people die from climate change, from radical rainfall. All around the planet, we're looking at millions of climate refugees, all because the Republican Party decided that greed was more important than anything else. And in this case, they were embracing the greed of the fossil fuel industry. Yay, greed. Rod in Vernal, Utah. Hey, Rod, what's on your mind today?
Calling about the mega drought in the West.
Yeah.
And the effects it's having on the Great Salt Lake. The Great Salt Lake is disappearing.
That's in your state. Yeah.
Yes. It's down to a third of what it used to be.
Whoa. I would guess if it's lost two-thirds of its water, that means its salinity has increased to the point where things that could live in it before can't live in it now. Is that what's happening?
That's where it's getting to that point. They also, there's mining. They get minerals out of the lake.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that the Wasatch Mountains have such great snow for skiing is because of the lake effect.
So it evaporates into the mountains, and without that, you're no longer going to have snow in the mountains.
Right. They tested the lake bed, and the soil has a lot of toxins in it,
right,
including arsenic. And when the wind blows, it's going to blow it all over Salt Lake Valley.
I've read a piece about that, about how Salt Lake City and many of the communities around the Great Salt Lake were starting to have toxic air, and people were actually inhaling arsenic. And there was a concern that arsenic is a carcinogen. This is like not a good thing to be inhaling.
No. It's going to get worse. Right now, there's a hard crust on a lot of the lake bed that keeps that from happening. But as that erodes, it's just going to get worse. One of the local scientists said that it's possible that the whole Salt Lake Valley could become unlivable. So
would that include Salt Lake City?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah, it's right. It's not far from Salt Lake City.
You know, I see this coming. Over the weekend, I was working on this book on the history of American democracy and doing a deep dive into Native Americans. And I got this book, textbook. It's like a 400-page book, the final really thorough analysis, mostly based on DNA, of which people came to North America, when and where they went and how they traveled and where, you know, all this kind of stuff. And interesting, there's a whole bunch of DNA bloodlines essentially that died out, tribes that just like ceased to exist, and nobody's carrying their DNA anymore. And as I was reading this book over and over and over again, what I found was that it was local changes in climate, mostly local droughts, that caused civilizations, societies, cultures to literally vanish. In some cases, they moved elsewhere. In some cases, they just died out. And this was the norm for the human race for 300,000 years. I mean, we're living in a period of time that is very abnormal, right? In fact, I've been thinking about writing this for my op-ed this afternoon, because right now we're living in a time that is not the norm, where people are protected from nature, essentially. You know, we're protected from drought because we can drill deep wells and we can tap water sources. We're protected from heat by air conditioning. We're protected from cold by fossil fuel heating our homes. And we're hitting the edges of those things. We're coming to the limits of those things as a consequence of climate change.
Yeah, I just read recently, and I don't know where this came from, but they were saying it's the history of the human race that is societies become more and more successful, they reach a peak, and then the exploitation of the resources backfires on them, and they decline and, you know, maybe die out.
Yep.
And we've been able to avoid it because of our technology, but that's not going to save us.
That will help in the micro. That will help in local areas and local environments. But when you're talking about the macro, the large areas, I mean, we're already seeing literally tens of millions of climate refugees around the world right now. It's going to become hundreds of millions soon. And I think probably within 10 or 15 years, it's going to become billions. And the stress and strain that's going to put on the world, you know, you could expect to see resource wars erupting as a result of it.
Eventually, we'll be the immigrants. We'll be trying to move to places where it's not as hot.
Exactly. And this is all because we let the fossil fuel industry lie to us for 50 years. I mean, that's what it boils down to. If we had done something about this when the Reagan administration was first informed that this was coming down the road, we would be in a very different place in the world, frankly, because the United States so much leads the world technologically. If just Jimmy Carter's effort, not just the solar panels on the White House, but his solar bank that was going to provide a third of America or a quarter of America's electrical energy by the year 2000, if Reagan hadn't killed that in 1981, we would be in a very, very different place. Rod, thank you for the call, and thanks for sharing those details, those grim details with us. Steve in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind today?
Great show. I'm really glad people are calling in about climate change. It's like my number one issue, and for some reason it's not for a lot of people. I noticed one guy called in and said that people think that it's in the future, whereas really the ravages of climate change are happening now.
Right.
And I think that's true. But to me, an even bigger problem is so many people have given up already. Everybody's mourning. There's a lot of mourning about climate change,
right,
as if the climate was already dead, you know.
Yeah.
And I have another friend who's very liberal. He says he's worried about the world that his son will grow up in, but he's well off. He's a snowbird. He stays here in the summer and flies to Mexico every winter. Now, I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. I'll admit, like, if he stopped doing that, we would still have a lot of climate change.
Sure.
You know, but people are living their lives as if it's too late. And that really upsets me.
Which is just another excuse for inaction.
Yeah. The power of the people, we don't know our own power. There's only a few hundred people in Congress and the White House and the Supreme Court. There's millions of us. And people don't realize how powerful we are, and we should learn that and use our power to stop global warming, not only in our own lives, like you said, eating less meat, electric cars, but also we need a lot more pressure on our elected representatives.
Amen. Amen. Well said, Steve. Steve, thank you very much. David in Spotswood, New Jersey. Hey, David, thanks for watching us on YouTube. What's up?
I'm reading about soil. Soil is going to completely erode in 60 years, and it might mean the starvation of most of the world. If that's true, if the government could verify that, could they use the Common Clause section of the Constitution, not only regulate or make soil more renewable, but climate change itself?
Well, the science is pretty clear, David, and you're right. Number one, you know, between erosion and tillage, you know, our agricultural techniques, we've gone in some parts of the United States, for example, from having topsoil that was 6 and 7 feet deep down to topsoil that's 8 inches. You know, the topsoil is vanishing all over the planet, but in places with intensive modern mechanized agriculture, it's going even faster. And if you change from those kinds of agricultural techniques to the small-scale organic systems of agriculture, you rebuild the soil and you replenish it, bring it back, and you also sequester carbon. Those are all good things.
Right, because it would be more space for plants.
Yeah,
and livestock using it.
Yeah, and I would love to see. I don't think that bans are going to be possible, or you know, outright. I mean, politically, I can't imagine that the agriculture industry would allow Congress to pass something like that. They have so much power and so much wealth. But what you could do is start providing incentives to farmers, you know, whether it's tax breaks or even tax credits, subsidies, to shift from intensive agriculture, tillage agriculture and chemical agriculture over to organic agriculture, or what used to simply be called agriculture before the 1950s, you know, when we really went on this pesticide herbicide kick. You know, I think that would be a really good idea. Yeah, I think it would be a really good first step. Encouraging people like our government did during World War II to have what they call victory gardens, I think that would be a big deal also.
Okay, all good,
you know,
stuff.
Instead of lawns. So, you know, step by step.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Back in 2019, the official position of the United Nations IPCC was that the Arctic was warming twice as fast as the mid-latitudes, as where we live. Now, a new study was just published in the peer-reviewed journal Communications, Earth, and Environment. And what they found was that the Arctic is actually warming four times faster than the rest of the planet. And even faster than that in some areas, like near Svalbard. Now, Louise and I were in Svalbard a couple of, what, three, 4 years ago, Sean, when we were over there with the crew, with Leo DiCaprio, filming Ice on Fire, his latest environmental movie. And, I was interviewing these scientists. It's an amazing place. You know, it's an island off, you know, part of Norway, way up north, the Arctic Circle. And there's a university there, and there's all kinds of cool stuff, and a big climate center where they're monitoring methane, actually, in the ocean. And they said that that Eurasian sector of the Arctic Ocean is warming 1.25 degrees Celsius. That would be almost in the neighborhood of 2 degrees Fahrenheit every decade, every 10 years. I mean, we were all freaked out about 2 degrees or 3 degrees of warming, or even 4 or 5 degrees Fahrenheit between now and 2100. Well, you know, we're looking at 2 degrees Fahrenheit of warming every 10 years in that part of the world. And what's causing it is what's called Arctic amplification. Ice and snow reflect light and heat back into outer space. Some of it, of course, gets trapped by greenhouse gases, but a lot of it just escapes. But when that ice or snow melts and exposes either, you know, land, permafrost, brown land, or blue ocean, deep blue ocean, those absorb light and heat as opposed to reflecting them. And so that speeds up the process. This is what's called positive feedback, and it doesn't mean it's a good thing. It's not like positive good thing. It's like it's feeding on itself. And the Arctic is like, you know, the refrigerator for the Northern Hemisphere. It is the thing that stabilizes the jet stream. And the jet stream is what defines and determines our weather. And the instability of the jet stream that we've been seeing, that's getting progressively worse year after year, but we've been seeing this in a big way for about the last decade in a way that's identifiable, these bomb cyclones and these derechos and massive tropical storms and things. This is the direct result of the Arctic warming. Now, the other part of this story, this climate story, is what's going on in Europe right now. Just in the last 5 years, large parts of France and Spain have undergone the same kind of demoisturification. There's probably a scientific word for it. I don't know what it is. But, you know, loss of moisture in their forests so that their forests are starting to brown, their grasslands are dying, and as a result, there's these huge wildfires. Last night, Louise and I watched the BBC News for a half hour. They do a great, the BBC's USA service does a great, you know, they every hour, the first half hour is a really, really good news report, and then they follow that in the second half hour with an in-depth, kind of a feature piece. And they were showing these fires across France and Spain that are just, I mean, it's like California. It's the same thing. It's drying out. It's been drying out for years now. And it has reached a tipping point where it is starting to burn. And thousands of people have been evacuated. The Rhine River in Germany, an awful lot of product is shipped on the Rhine. They've been using that for transportation for 1,000 years.
or more. And the Rhine River has dropped now to such a level that the larger container ships, the larger cargo ships, can no longer travel on the river. The river's just not deep enough. The head of the European Space Agency has said that the heat waves and the drought are going to dwarf Europe's energy crisis as this economic damage comes on. Also, the crops are failing all across Europe as a result of this drought. This is serious, dangerous, destructive stuff that is happening. It's all the result of climate change, and I think probably for the first time, the rest of the world, I mean, obviously the Republican Party still has their heads up there, well, in the sand, let's say, you know, because they're still receiving massive infusions of cash every month from the fossil fuel industry. But outside of the Republican Party in the United States, there is literally not another political party in any democratic nation that continues to deny climate change and continues to try to obstruct any kind of forward motion on climate change, because they are so beholden to these fossil fuel billionaires, you know, the whole Koch network and their buddies, and the fossil fuel industry. So we'll see how this plays out. But Europe is waking up, and large parts of the United States are waking up. We're waking up to the lies that have been told to us by the fossil fuel industry. We're waking up to the lies that have been told to us by wannabe fascist politicians like Donald Trump. Step one here. Ways the Biden and the Democrats are protecting the environment. This is part of the good news roundup over on dailycos.com. It's a great read. I'll summarize it for you. Number one, Biden rejoined the Paris Climate Accords. This is a huge deal. I mean, Donald Trump pulled us out of the Paris Accords because he and the Republican Party were taking, I don't know specifically how much he took, but the Republican Party in general had been taking literally hundreds of millions, perhaps billions of dollars over the years from the fossil fuel industry, from fossil fuel billionaires, and from foundations and groups aligned with both. You know, they wanted to get us out of the Paris Climate Accords because they wanted to be able to continue to pollute with impunity and in the process make as much profit as possible. And Biden said, no, we're going to rejoin the Paris Accords. Number two, Biden expanded wind farms. This is great. The Departments of Interior, Energy, and Commerce are all working together to increase our offshore wind energy capacity, which, by the way, is some of the most reliable wind out there. The Departments of Energy, Interior, and Commerce committed to a shared goal of generating 30 gigawatts, 30 billion watts of offshore wind in the U.S. by 2030. The Interior Department estimates that reaching that goal would create nearly 80,000 jobs. Of course, it is still being blocked by, or, I mean, this was an effort that they took that they didn't need Congress for, so they succeeded. But any effort by Congress to do something like this would be blocked by Republicans who are in the deep, deep pockets of the fossil fuel industry. Number three, Biden and the Democrats made the largest investment in railroads since Amtrak was created. That's a good thing. Number four, Biden revoked the Keystone XL pipeline permit. Again, this has nothing to do with the price of gas in the United States. This coal slurry that runs through that pipeline is not made into gasoline. It's made into heavier things like diesel fuel and you know, other kinds of oils, you know, like that. And it's for export. They're trying to ship this stuff from Canada down to the Gulf Coast, not because there's a huge demand for this thing in Texas and Louisiana, but because that's where there's a port and they can put it on ships and ship it out of the United States. So we refine it. We get the pollution, which is why you've got Cancer Alley from East Texas all the way through Louisiana, you know, all the way downwind from these refineries. We get the pollution. The people who own the refineries, and it used to be the Koch brothers, I don't know if it still is, but the people who own the refineries get the profits, and other countries get the oil. And Biden said, no, this is stupid, and it was. So good on him for that. Number five, Biden protected endangered species. He reversed two Trump-era rules that ended defense of endangered species in the United States. That's a big deal. Number six, he increased the use of renewable energy. This was by executive order. Under an executive order, the federal government would phase out the purchase of gasoline-powered vehicles and federal government buildings, which are not inconsequential. There's a lot of them. Federal government buildings would be powered by wind, solar, or other clean energy. Number seven, Biden is cleaning up long-ignored toxic sites. Now, you'll recall, I believe it was during the Nixon administration. It might have been after that. It was after the Love Canal thing melted down. And frankly, I don't remember what year it was, but it was in that neighborhood of the 70s to the 80s. We started this fund, this Superfund cleanup that was funded originally. The Superfund cleanup projects were funded by the polluters themselves. So if you're a chemical company and you're going to pollute, you know, you're going to have a toxic landfill, you have to pay in advance for the cost of cleaning that thing up. Well, that got done away with by one of the Republican administrations. And as a consequence of that, companies had just been walking away from their toxic landfills. And the federal government picked up that slack with a Superfund fund of its own, but it has been cut dramatically. It was cut dramatically during the Bush and Trump administrations. So Biden has reversed that. He signed legislation reviving a polluter's tax, and he's expected to raise $14.5 billion in revenue over the next 10 years, and would accelerate the cleanup of these Superfund sites. The Superfund list, by the way, includes more than 1,300 abandoned mines, radioactive landfills, shuttered military labs, closed factories, and other contaminated areas across all 50 states, every single one of which was a major contributor to the profits of their owners at the time, and every single one of which is now being paid for. The cleanup is being paid for by you and me. This is how capitalism works in America, when capitalists can buy the votes of legislators. Number eight, Biden has halted federal aid to new fossil fuel projects overseas. Another big deal. For the first time, it bars the U.S. government from backing future ventures. Number nine, Biden protected trees. Remember Bush's Healthy Forests Initiative that allowed for clear-cutting of forests? The outgoing Trump administration slashed federal protection for Alaska's Songus National Forest, the world's largest intact temperate rainforest. Biden reversed these policies. Oh, and they also stopped protecting more than 3 million acres here in the Pacific Northwest of habitat for the spotted owl. And Biden reversed those policies and multiple other anti-environmental policies of the Trump administration after taking office. Number 10, Biden reduced climate emissions from cars. He wasn't able to get this through Congress. You know, Joe Manchin, Mr. I'll take money from the fossil fuel and to hell with my children and grandchildren's future, blew this up. But Biden was able to do an EPA rule to cut climate pollutions from new cars and light trucks. Number 11, Biden protected 3 million acres of land, some of our most precious land, the Bears Ears National Park and the 1.87 million acre Grand Staircase Escalante Monument. He also reimposed fishing restrictions in the Northeast Canyons and the Seamounts National Marine Monument off the Atlantic that Trump had opened to commercial fishing. And finally, number 12, Biden is making light bulbs more efficient. And I think this is a particularly important deal because if you buy an electric car, the amount of electricity that your car is going to draw off your house and thus off the power grid, electric cars typically charge at the rate of about 1,300-1,400 watts drawing electricity, about the same as an electric toaster. Well, if you've got 100-watt light bulbs and you replace 10 of them with 3-4-watt LED bulbs, you have just freed up enough electricity to charge your car and not change your electric bills and not increase your demand on the grid. So this is a big deal. And the Department of Energy has proposed a requirement that everyday light bulbs meet a fuel efficiency standard, which is easily achieved with today's LEDs. This was supposed to take effect in the last year of the Trump administration, but Trump set that aside. Right now, using old light bulbs costs consumers $300 million a year in needless energy bills and causes 800,000 tons of CO2 emissions into the atmosphere, which are absolutely unnecessary because these new LED lights are so much more efficient. So a lot going on there that, you know, we can deal with, we can do things about, and the Biden administration, some really consequential improvements in our environment. It's a good thing.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.